You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Jessica Hendry Nelson, whose new memoir is If Only You People Could Follow Directions. Raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Jessica Hendry Nelson earned a BA in English from the University of New Hampshire and an MFA in writing from Sarah Lawrence College. Her work has been published, or is forthcoming, from the Threepenny Review, the Carolina Quarterly, Crab Orchard Review, Painted Bride Quarterly, Drunken Boat, Alligator Juniper, Fringe, and Pank. A chapter from If Only You People Could Follow Directions. The Whitest Winter Light won first place in Alligator Juniper's National Nonfiction Contest and is a notable essay in Best American Essays 2012. Here Fishy Fishy was a finalist in Crab Orchard Review's 2011 John Guyon Literary Prize competition, and the title piece was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Nelson teaches writing at Johnson State College. In 2013, she co-founded the Renegade Writers Collective in Burlington, Vermont. She has been the senior nonfiction editor of The Fiddleback, a literary journal. If Only You People Could Follow Directions is a spellbinding debut that reimagines the memoir in Jessica Hendry Nelson's thoroughly original voice. In these linked essays, Nelson's fearless writing and hypnotic storytelling centers on the story of three people: Nelson's mother, Susan, her brother, Eric, and Jessica herself. These three characters are deeply bound to one another, not just by the unusual ties of blood and family, but also by a mother's drive to keep her children safe in the midst of chaos. The book begins with Nelson's childhood in the suburbs of Philadelphia and chronicles her father's addiction and death, her brother's battle with drugs and mental illness, her own efforts to find and maintain stability, and her mother's exquisite power, grief, and self-destruction in the face of such complicated family dynamics. Each of the book's chapters concerns a different relationship. Friends, lovers, and strangers are all at play, but at its heart, the book is about family, the ties that bind, enrich, and betray us, and how one young woman sought to rise above her perilous surroundings. If Only You People Could Follow Directions has received glowing reviews from such publications as Elle, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and O, the Oprah Magazine, which named it one of 10 books that will change your point of view. Kirkus gave the book a starred review, saying, quote, "It takes a virtuoso writer to make another familial memoir of addiction seem as vital and compelling as this stunning debut does." When I spoke with Jessica Hendry Nelson early in February, I asked if the essay had always been her favorite genre.
That's a good question. I wrote from a very young age, but, you know, I wrote... my mother loves to tell this story. I wrote a series of books at five called the Honey Bear series. She still has it. She still loves to bring it out at holidays. It's fully illustrated. It's the adventures of four honey bears. Okay. And they go to school, and they go to synagogue, and they go to... but I think in high school, I really was always drawn to the essay. Always wrote essay. And when I got to college, I experimented a lot, and I wrote poetry, bad poetry, and fiction. But it was really the essay that just I kept coming back to always, and probably always will.
So, do you write any fiction?
I'm writing more fiction now, more than I ever have, and I think my next book I think will be a collection of novellas. So I'm moving more in that direction, but I think I'll always return to the essay.
Yeah. And to what extent do your essays always sort of have some aspect of memoir?
Usually. I mean, I do some nature writing, and but there's usually the personal is always that element.
Okay.
Is always there.
All right.
As a way to see things differently, to relate to my life in different ways, and to relate to nature in different ways, and whatever it is I'm researching. But I'm just, yeah, hopelessly in love with memoir.
Great. Your book is If Only You People Could Follow Directions. It's published by Counterpoint Press. It's made up of linked personal essays. I wondered when you decided these essays would become a book. When did you start thinking about creating this as a one larger project?
It was late. I had many of these essays before I started conceiving them as a whole. And I was in graduate school. It was my last day of graduate school, and I had a professor who said to me, "Oh, these will make a beautiful book." And he said it in a way as if it was a given, and I had not before conceived of making this into a book. And the minute he said it, it just clicked. That was it. That's exactly what I'd been working on and just hadn't realized it, or hadn't wanted to realize it,
wow.
I think.
How many of these were written when he said that?
Most of them. Most of them, I think. I think I probably have four that I wrote since then, but most of them were written.
And were there more that you decided not to include?
There were a few, and a few that I wanted to include that my editor didn't want to include.
Oh, okay.
But I'm really pleased with its final form. I think this is the book it was supposed to be.
Right.
I hate when people say that, but it does feel like that.
Yeah. Earlier this week, you had a review in the LA Review of Books, and Jill Talbot wrote the review. And one of the things that she said was that one of the most significant and daring aspects of this book, your literary debut, is addiction in the present tense. And that's true. You know, a lot of the opening essay is a very intense, interesting letter that you write to your brother, and it is in the present tense, and it talks about your father and his history of addiction and your brother's own struggle. So I'm wondering if you could read from the prologue, and then we'll be able to talk a little bit about that present tense and also the pace of the prologue.
Sure.
Okay, great.
A letter to Eric. You and I visit our father on Saturdays between the hours of 1 and 2. We visit him alongside the other children and the other fathers. The building is low and concrete, and we visit outside. We visit him wearing blue jeans and wool sweaters and new sneakers. It is 1989, it is 1991, it is 1992, and then it is 1995. It is Livingren Foundation for Addiction Recovery, or it is the Karen Foundation, or it is this rehab or that. It is by farmland and fences and old graveyards and small airports. Mothers like ours wait in the car, or else they sit beside the children and kiss their men on the mouth and stroke the children's hair. Everyone sits at picnic tables on the lawn, and the fathers talk and smoke, and the children listen and are shy. Most of the men wear mustaches and tan work boots and flannel shirts. They look like they've only just put down their hammers for a quick lunch and a chat, while behind them some new house might be teetering dangerously, all stud-stripped and soft concrete. The men look interrupted rather than finished, and maybe that's what we find so surprising. Our father looks baffled, as I imagine that Mexican farmer looked when the Paracutin volcano appeared in his cornfield overnight. That was 1943. I'm reading about it in school. These things happen, they tell us. One day you wake up and find a giant stinking hole where your life used to be. We visit him in the hospital at 3 in the morning, and we eat bags of chips from the vending machine. It is 1990. We wear our pajamas under our coats and play tic-tac-toe on the backs of our mother's crumpled receipts. We are giddy to be up so late. We feel like explorers in a parallel universe, a place children seldom go, and we plan to report back. When he comes into the waiting room, he looks just like our father, only minus two teeth and with a nose we hadn't imagined could get any crookeder. We give him hugs and potato chips. He smiles with his lips closed, then he starts to speak, and we get scared and cry. His mouth is a deep red cave with shards of teeth dangling like stalactites, which I am also reading about in school. We visit him in their room one morning and crawl under the blankets, and he says, "What is this? What are these lumps in my bed?" And pats our wriggling heads and backs and bottoms, and we bounce around and laugh so hard we knock our heads together. It is 1989. We visit him in jail and bring a deck of cards, your soccer trophy, and a carton of Camel Lights. The guards make us leave it all in a box at the desk, and we forget to take your trophy on the way out. It is 1992. It is the Montgomery County Correctional Facility, or it is the Bucks County Correctional Facility. It is drunk driving, or petty theft, or unpaid child support. You cry for hours over your trophy, hiccuping and drooling, until we turn on the Flintstones and you forget. When the show is over, you look at me in surprise and start in again, but your heart's not in it. We visit him in another rehab and watch football on a small TV with no sound. He introduces us to his friends, and he looks proud, and they smile politely and clap our shoulders. He offers us gifts, a keychain with a dangling pink peace sign, packs of Starburst candy, an old Highlights magazine with some doctor's address on the white sticker, a rubber refrigerator magnet of Joe Camel in sunglasses, shooting pool with the word smooth emblazoned on his t-shirt, everything wrapped neatly in newspaper. He offers us coffee from a big silver pot, and you say, okay, sure, even though you're only 8, and he pours some into a styrofoam cup and hands it to you, and you dump it out later when it goes to the bathroom. It is 1994.
Great. Thank you very much for reading that. And that, sure. And that letter goes on, and it's just got this wonderful sort of mesmerizing pace to it.
Thank you.
And then is it in the present tense, as Jill Talbot talks about. And I think that one thing that she was really drawn to was just that the present tense keeps the addiction very immediate, and the subject of addiction is very immediate. And the treatment of addiction in the book is just sort of like as this constant. It's not fixed, and it's not mended. So anyway, I wondered if you can talk a little bit about writing that letter. I assume you wrote a real letter. Mm. It's not just for the book. Yeah. So was that just something that tumbled out of you, or did you then later restructure it to put into the book in a certain way?
I have two answers to that. I wrote the letter shortly after my brother had overdosed on heroin. I wrote it a few days after that, so it was very much present, and it is still present. And I think anyone who suffers from addiction or has family members who suffer from addiction, it's always in the present tense. It's never done or put away. And so one thing I was very conscious of in writing these essays is making sure that it wasn't something that was put to bed, and I didn't want it to come across like, you know, this is the book of addiction, this is recovery, this is salvation, it's over, done, goodbye, because, mm-hmm. you know, it certainly isn't. So, you know, in particular with this essay, I originally had it at the end of the book because it was the last piece I wrote. It was a letter to my brother. He had just overdosed. And
what year was that?
That was 2012, I believe.
Okay.
And we, you know, I didn't know. We didn't know, you know, and especially with heroin addiction, you know, you wake every day thinking this could be his last day. Mm-hmm. So that's where I was when I wrote the letter. It was very omnipresent, and it was really my editor's decision or idea to move it to the front of the book rather than at the end of the book. But I'm glad that he made that suggestion, because I think it sort of encapsulates everything that's to come and brings the book full circle and leaves it in that place where things are ongoing and not resolved, because
right.
It's not resolvable.
And the other thing about the letter is, because it talks about your father's story as well as your brother's story, and that's all your own story as well, it's such a beautiful introduction to all of these characters. They're real people, but they're characters to us,
right.
who we're about to be introduced to and their situations. And it's just, I thought it was a wonderful way to open the book.
It works really well in that way. And I didn't see it, and I fought against it for a long time because it felt almost a little like a preview. But mm-hmm. but I see now that it really does work to introduce the characters,
right.
And give you a sense of who they are.
Yeah. One thing that I was really struck by in reading If Only You People Could Follow Directions is your use of transition, both from essay to essay, but more specifically within the essays. And for example, there's one essay, and I think it's the one, Here Fishy Fishy, is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So you and your brother used to fight when you were little, physical brawls. And there's this one fight that you have in a hotel room. It's sort of the turning point for these fights. You know, he's actually going to be able to fight back at this point. And you relay this in the essay, and then you transition into a scene from another day where you and your brother went into Philadelphia to see an art exhibit. And it's really a dance exhibit where ballet dancers are fitted with mics, and you are able to hear their exertion as they are dancing. And you were very struck by this, and just sort of what it is to exert energy. And you say, this is a quote, "It was maybe the first time I realized how two opposing truths could exist at the same time, beauty and pain, light and dark, love and hate." And then you briefly bring in the physicality of your father passed out on the floor in another room, you know, when he was using drugs or alcohol. The weave of these moments is so beautiful, and the transitions between these scenes and your realization, and also sort of an underlying truth about beauty and pain and how much that relates in this book. So I wonder if you remember writing those scenes and putting them together in this way, and if we can talk a little bit about transition and your approach to transition.
Sure. Transition is something that I struggled with for a long time in my writing, and my way of dealing with it for a long time was to just not do them, just not write transitions at all. And that sort of worked for me, in that, you know, as I developed as a writer, they became less non-transitions, but they, you know, they have logic. But I don't like to do the hand-holding through transition. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather let the moments and let the juxtaposition do the work of the transition rather than having to spell it out. So, and with the transitions that you mentioned, that's interesting because I do remember being very conscious writing that piece and thinking about that moment when we had fought, how little was actually said and how much was just in our breathing and gesture and the physicality of it, really the physicality.
Right.
And how in families, you know, so much of your communication is a physical abutment, you know, whether it's tenderness or violence. And certainly with my brother and me, you know, we were together so much growing up, whether we liked it or not, that, you know, we were colliding all the time. So in good and bad ways, you know.
And I think what you just said is so true. Like, you're clearly not holding the hand of your reader, and yet there is such a really obvious sense that you love your brother and that there is this love, and then there's this sort of like, man, I'm going to totally beat you up, you know? And
I love you so much, I just want to beat your head in.
Exactly. Okay. There was another transition that's perhaps maybe more artfully conscious. I just loved it though, and it was in the essay titled Fall, which is the essay about your father's death. He was drunk and he had a seizure and he fell down a flight of stairs, and you write about this in conjunction with a trip that you took to Scotland. And on that trip you're on a bus tour and the driver has to stop to clear a sheep out of the road because it has fallen from a cliff and died. And you know, maybe I'm slow, but as I was reading this essay, I didn't really start to think about the interrelationship of these two events until you started going back and forth between them. And you did so sort of increasingly more frequently, as, you know, like, it seems to me that maybe the moments in each scene became a little bit shorter and they went back and forth. And I'm just wondering if we can talk a little bit about that one and your decision to present these two moments together.
This is an early essay, and I wrote it a long time ago, but I do remember being very conscious of sort of the ecstasy and tragedy in witnessing these sheeps in a way that I hadn't witnessed my father, but really saw sort of ecstasy and tragedy in his death, in the way that he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it, you know, building that momentum, so by making the scene shorter and shorter, I think I was really, in my mind, trying to rectify what I had been able to witness and what I couldn't witness, and trying to understand what happened with my father that night through what I was able to see in Scotland. And of course, the two have nothing to do with one another. But
well, they do and they don't. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is that this happens, I guess, a lot in Scotland, and the sheep are eating some plant that really does sort of make them stoned.
Stoned.
And they make mistakes about what they're doing. So, in fact, you know, they're inebriated and they fall. And,
yeah.
And there is a real parallel there. So did you think about that at the time when you were in Scotland, the parallel of...
I think it wasn't until later that I really thought about it consciously, but I was thinking about how, you know, even in the animal world, we sort of chase these highs, we sort of chase this, whether it's, you know, height, literally height, vertical, or, you know, getting stoned, getting outside of oneself, you know, climbing, and they'll eat the dried heather, and they'll continue to climb high, as they can, and then... they're stoned and then they fall off, and it happens all the time, especially in the Isle of Skye, which I just thought was really fascinating. But
yeah,
it's not just sheep. I mean, deer do it too. They
wow.
eat, you know, like the spoiled apples, and they get drunk, and I think it's, yeah, just the, and you know, so, and I was reading more and more about different instances of animals, you know, getting either drunk or stoned, and just seeing, you know, parallels in our human behavior and how that also translates in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, that was really... I thought that was a really beautiful way to present this story. And part of the reason that I also liked it was that you go on in the book to talk about how you never saw your father's body, and that was a regret for you. So it almost felt like, in thinking back on this essay, you know, there was some moment where you were able to see... this creature in the road, and you never were able to see that in your own life and your father. So I was also going to ask you about that, not having seen your father's body and that being a point of regret. Is that still a regret for you, or do you think you've come to terms with that?
A yes and no. I mean, it's still, there is something, and it's the reason we hold wakes. It's the reason we as humans have always made a habit of witnessing the body, where it makes it real. It makes it tangible. And I was really upset about that for a long time, that I, because it felt, and especially because my father had been in and out of our lives for so long, that it could have just been another extended absence. And there was something about not being able to actually see his body that made it, you know, sort of, I felt like I was in a fugue state for a long time.
Closure,
you know, what for whatever that's worth. But I, you know, I understand why at that time. I was only 17, 18, and my mother had just made that decision for us.
Which seems like a completely reasonable decision.
And it does. And, it, you know, yeah. And it's fine now. You know, it is fine. But there is still a small part of me that regrets that I couldn't have that moment. Ugly and sad and awful as it may be.
Well, we mentioned that you went to Scotland when you were a student, and you also in the book talk about going to Italy and just a lot of travel, and there's a sort of theme of running away as another form of addiction. And I liked that you brought that to the theme of the larger theme of the book.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I am definitely a bit of a gypsy.
Do you still?
Still.
Yeah.
It's very hard for me to stay put for very long. And I don't think this is terribly uncommon, but I tend to get restless in one place and have, you know, notions of, you know, if I could just take off and replant myself somewhere else, it would fix everything, you know, and of course it doesn't. So I'm just trying. You know, I've been in Burlington now for 2 years.
Woohoo!
It's the longest I've been anywhere in over 10 years. And it feels good, and I'm trying to, you know, I still, on any given day, will have fantasies of picking up and moving to.
Does that feed your writing, the fact that you like to move to a new place? Will you be energized to write when you get to a new place?
I am. Yeah. I am energized in new places. And this is common, too. I mean, I hear a lot of writers talk about this, but it's much easier to write about a place when you are not in it. So, you know, to write about Philly, it helps to not be in Philly. To write about, you know, Scotland or England, it helps to not be there. So it helps to go and then to leave and then to have that bit of perspective to write about place in a way that, is breathing and real.
Now that reminds me of another question I was going to ask you, which is that I love your beautiful use of detail. You just always have these lovely, perfect details. And it made me wonder if the details come out for you when you're writing or if you take notes all the time. And I mean, what made me think of this is when you say it's easier to write in a place when you're not there. But if you're not there, you're not visually like experiencing it and not experiencing it firsthand. So are you, do you take a lot of notes or do you just remember? Do you have an amazing memory?
I think I am good at imagining the past.
Okay.
Which is, I think, different than like a photorealist memory, you know. So I remember sensibility, I remember feeling, you know, in a way that's really ephemeral. And then I can sort of build the detail and the description around a feeling or a sense of being. Mm-hmm. I had a professor once who said, sit in a chair in the middle of your scene and just observe. And I do that. You know, I think I do, but I'm not a note taker. I wish I was.
I don't think you need to be.
Well,
this is working for you.
I try to take notes and but then sometimes I just trust that maybe the good stuff will stick somewhere and it comes out eventually, maybe in some form, hopefully.
Yeah. Do you mind if I read like a little bit?
Sure.
From the book? This was like just literally, I just sort of was like flipping through and opening to any page to see where to mention detail. And there's just so, I could have picked any one of the pages I opened to, but this one I loved. And I'm not going to read it through to the end because I don't want to give away the moment. But you are in Maine. You are at a cabin with your boyfriend, Nick. To the south, the sky is colorless and the land behind this frozen air is metallic and drained. Suddenly, everything feels sped up like a cartoon, which makes me gasp for air and grab instinctively for the terrace railing, my mug dropping into the snow and disappearing for good. We shouldn't be here, not now, as the empty sky beats back a silver sun and the dead trees draw arrows for the stars. I think I see a figure in the distance, his long, stringy legs braced against a slanting mountain bluff, two giant splintering shin bones thrust like javelins into the ice. I pray, don't let go. I look for Nick, but he is at the bottom of a deep centrifuge, smiling up at me from a long time ago. So I love that. There's this great sense use of detail, but also, as you say, maybe sort of imagining into the past makes it a little bit more. It's almost like magical realism in certain moments. Mm. You know, it's like it seems impressionistic or something. I don't know.
I like that magical realism. I mean,
it's not like your whole book has a magical realism happening in the storyline, but in moments, definitely.
Sure. And in that piece in particular, I think, was so much about fantasy and the fantasies that we, and the stories, you know, the narratives that we make up about our life, even as it's happening, maybe especially as it's happening. So, you know, that was as much about what was happening in the present tense as it was about the story we were sort of crafting together in our young, naive relationship.
Okay. All right. There's an essay in the book called The Dollhouse, which I think what I really loved about The Dollhouse is, The Dollhouse is about your paternal grandmother, Cynthia, and the relationship you had with her. And you know, a lot of times I'll read people's family histories and I'll say, oh, this person's like this other person in my family or something like that. And the thing I loved about The Dollhouse was I don't have anybody like Cynthia.
But lucky.
But I felt this sense of her. I mean, just such an incredibly complex woman. So one thing that I really liked is that you quickly establish her as a sort of questionable character or downright unlikable in certain ways, but you also established your childhood self as having adored her and adored her attention. And this created a complication that made for a much better read, I thought, in the essay. So I wondered if you can talk a little bit about writing this piece and recalling your grandmother on the page.
This was one of the few instances of having to wait until someone died to write about that.
I'm wondering about that.
I, you know, always wanted to write about Cynthia. Cynthia was a very complicated character, and a complicated woman. And I'm glad that you say that I sort of reached and got some of the complexities, but for whatever eighth of the complexities I managed to get across in this essay, there are so many more. Mm. And she was infinitely frustrating and manipulating and also wonderful and changed my life in lots and lots of ways. And I didn't know how to really tell that story without being really honest about my complicity in it. And
which was wonderful. I thought that just made your narration so much more honest and believable. So
I had to. I couldn't tell that story without being honest, but because I was complicit. It's intoxicating to have someone lavish so much attention on you, even while you know that person, you know, is ignoring your sibling or disparaging, you know, or putting down other members of your family, especially as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, that's confusing. Mm-hmm. And I let it go on far too long. There's nothing about this book that felt like confessionalism to me, but I did have to confess to my part in that if I was going to do her any justice, I think, and do that story any justice, and just to render that relationship in its all its myriad ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, I went to your book launch at the Phoenix bookstore for this book, and your mother and your brother were there, and he asked a question. He said, was it hard for you to paint yourself as occasionally unsympathetic? I don't know how he worded it, but that was sort of the gist of his question. And when I read the book, I hadn't yet read the book at that point, when I read the book, I wondered if he was mostly referring to this essay and to that experience in your lives. Do you think that might be?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about that, actually, at the time. But he probably was referring mostly to this story because it is something that we've talked about so much, and had very honest conversations, and he's called me out in my part in this relationship with her, and it's been a divide for a while, and I think he understands sort of why I was vulnerable to her and why I didn't stand up for him more, and you know, and I'm sorry for that, you know, and I think he knows that. I hope he knows that. I mean, we've talked about it, and I regret that.
It's interesting because it is the kind of regret that we carry into adulthood for the crimes that we committed starting as children, you know, when you have no power at all, right? So that's my little two cents.
And you hold it, though, and you hold it, and it doesn't go away. I will always regret not sticking up for him more in that relationship, even while I know it wouldn't have done any good, you know? I mean, she had it set in her mind that men were bad, and she had a lot of men who were bad in her life. So it wouldn't have changed anything, but it would have made a difference to Eric.
And your relationship with your brother.
And our relationship, for sure.
While we're talking about Eric and your mom, I was wondering how your family reacted to the book and how was, I mean, you know, I think that you convey, if nothing else, a great deal of love and tenderness to your family, every single person, really, including Cynthia. But you paint with a very honest brush and you're very, you know, clear and truthful about your memories of your experiences with these people in your life. So how did they react?
You know, I'm very lucky that I have the most gracious family, and we're very open about our flaws. We talk about our screw-ups a lot. So it wasn't new to them. I think it wasn't new to them. And I've also been writing these essays for a long time, but they were nothing but supportive. And I do feel a lot of sympathy for writers whose family members are not as generous with their stories or with their flaws. And I think that they, particularly my mother, my brother, feel that if their story could, you know, at least not help people, but at least be a more honest picture of what addiction looks like and who we are, then that's fine for them. Mm.
I think about being a person who's been written about, you know, and I think because I participate in a community of writers, my perspective is always that, well, you know, anybody has ownership over their own story, and if that story spills into other people's stories, well, so be it, but that's how we write. But if you weren't a writer and you were written about, you know, it might be hard to be generous, and that's really saying something about their generosity that they, yeah.
Absolutely. I think about it a lot, especially, you know, about the people that I wrote about who I'm not in touch with anymore. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask permission, and they have no control over how I wrote about them. And I have complicated feelings about that. You know, on the one hand, I feel that way, that this is my story, too. And yet, you know, I'm trying to imagine, you know, the other side of the coin. I got an email recently from a woman who I'd written about in this book, and she was my good friend when we were kids. And I wrote about experiences that we had as very young kids. And she wrote to say she was really sorry and that she was ashamed of her behavior when we were kids. And I felt so terrible. That just broke my heart, because I think that the point of that essay was not to condemn her or her behavior or my behavior or anyone's behavior, but to talk about, you know, how little girls are really impressionable and how relationships between little girls are really idiosyncratic and formative, and I'm sorry that didn't translate to her, you know. Mm. And I'm thinking about it a lot now that the book is out in the world.
Is there a scene where you're a little embarrassed to see her later?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's...
There's a scene where I come across her in a grocery store when we're teenagers, and I hadn't seen her for a long time. And I was embarrassed, you know, you know, as teenagers can be. I was not kind. And yeah. And because she had, you know, not cool clothes on and was pudgy and, you know, and I was... just ashamed and
trying to impress other people
and trying to impress, you know, my cool new friends and just being an awful human being.
Did you change the names of people in the book?
I changed the names of everyone except for my family members.
Okay. Yeah. I want to talk about one more thing from the Cynthia essay from The Dollhouse.
Sure.
Cynthia was your grandmother, as we said, and her own father had been in love with a Parisian burlesque dancer. Before he met Cynthia's mother. I think the dancer's name was Lucienne, is that right? Right. And he had a photograph of her that Cynthia kept behind her desk, and now you have it. And in the book, you write about how Cynthia imagined Lucienne's life. She, I guess, told you what she had imagined about this woman's life. She didn't really know what her story was, but she kind of came up with a story for her. And then you later reimagine Lucienne's life. You give her a totally different background, and she's sort of like a muse to each of you, but she inspires these different impulses, and you both liked to think about who she was. I loved this diversion from the story into fantasy, but those fantasies told the reader a lot about who each of you is. I wonder if you can talk about including Lucienne in the book. That was one of my favorite moments, was reading your impressions of who this woman might have been.
She's sort of this angel character that has just existed in our lives, and she's still in my bedroom. I look at her every day. She's beautiful. And Cynthia, one of her favorite pastimes was to sort of fantasize about this woman's life. I think also because she disliked her mother so much,
right,
and loved her father very fiercely. And part of her, I think, regretted that her father wasn't able to have this relationship with this woman. And so she would just fill Lucienne with these stories. And she became just this vessel, just this device to make up the stories of our own lives, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The fantasies about our own alternative realities, and And I picked up this habit, you know, mm-hmm. as soon as I adopted Lucia, and I just, she's captivating. You know, when you look at her picture, she's captivating. So it's hard not to sort of read into her life and try to reimagine it in lots of different ways. But it is interesting how we both pick this poor, helpless woman stuck in a photograph to serve as this device.
Well, she's been immortalized, so.
She is.
You know, it's funny because reading that, I felt a little bit for Cynthia's mother that he had kept this photograph of this beautiful, exotic, sort of mysterious woman. And then I thought, well, I was glad to read that Cynthia's mother wasn't really a very nice woman. So I didn't have to feel sorry for her.
Well, and of course, you know, all we know of Cynthia's mother is Cynthia's version of Cynthia's mother. So that's all I have to work, you know, and I'm sure there are shades of that story that are not, you know, always the kindest or the most, you know, the most loving. But so be it. This is what we have,
right,
you know.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about your experience getting this book published. This is your first book. So did you, how did you go about finding a publisher? Did you get an agent first? And what was the process of finding an agent like for you?
I have an agent, and she's wonderful, Joanne Wyckoff at Carol Mann Agency. And she was referred to me through an old professor of mine and read some of my work, early work, well before this book was finished. So I had been in touch with her before I even had anything to sell.
Okay. Which is unusual. Which she would be willing to consider that.
And she was wonderful and took the time to spend an hour on the phone with me, you know, 6 months before I had anything to give her. And she just did a wonderful job. You know, we went through the process, and it was a roller coaster of submitting and rejections and maybe acceptances and then phone calls and interviews, and it was a very hard process emotionally.
So did she sign you before you had a book?
No, we didn't end up signing until after the book was done, but we were in touch, and she would check in with me every few months and say, you know, how are things coming along, and so she was just a great supporter. I was really lucky to have her, and you know, and then it felt very real. Like I, you know, it made the finishing of the book a little bit easier because I felt like I might actually have an avenue, you know, and that there was someone who actually cared whether this book got produced or not. I wanted to please her in a way.
Yeah.
I wanted to give back to her, you know, for actually having faith in this book. And then ended up with Counterpoint and was so just very lucky to have found them because they, and particularly my editor, Dan Smetanka, loved the form of this book. And with some of the bigger publishing houses, they said lots of things like, well, we love this book, but it has to be written chronologically. Mm-hmm. And that's not at all what I wanted to do with it. And Dan got that and wanted it in its, you know, in the essay form and understood why that was really important and wanted to preserve that. And just a very smart
editor. So they actually wanted to pull apart the essays that had various time periods and stick them all. Wow.
They wanted me to rewrite it.
Wow.
Chronologically.
Wow.
And I really didn't.
No.
That was not at all.
No.
So thank goodness, you know, that I found a publisher that was happy with the form and understood why it was really critical to the book.
So did you turn down larger publishers because of that? Or did Counterpoint come in on a white horse before you had to make that decision?
No, I was turned down. And not necessarily because I refused to rewrite it, but because it, you know, the way it works is usually there's like a junior editor at a house, and I think there were a few junior editors who really loved the book, and then when they took it to their higher ups, the powers that be, it was always the same feedback, you know, that it would have to be chronological, and so they didn't end up making offers, which is fine in hindsight.
Right. I don't understand. I mean, I can't imagine thinking that readers wouldn't get this book if it weren't chronological. So what would you say that's about? Do you know? Did they explain what they
thought? No, I mean, I don't want to presume what any one house is, you know, their objectives. But I do think that the sellability of memoir is difficult. The sellability of short story collections is difficult. And the sellability of essay collections is especially difficult.
Okay.
So I think it's a marketing, you know, a market decision that you know, we, for whatever reason, as much as we love them as a culture, essay is a hard sell.
Hmm.
And they of course have to think about those things, you know, as the publishing industry changes and wanes and
It's interesting though too, because I would say blogs, if anything, are closest to the essay. And people are reading more and more and more, maybe not better and better all the time, blogs, but that seems to be where our focus is turning, so it's just interesting.
It is interesting to me, too, and I'm happy to see that there were some short story collections in the past year that really were bestsellers.
Right.
You know, Claire Vey Watkins' Battleborn and George Saunders' new book, and that's promising.
Edith Perlman. Yeah.
But for whatever reason, and you know, we talk so much about how our attention spans are shortened, and we're, you know, we're clicking here and there, and you know, we can't read sustained narratives anymore. And yet, still, the market seems to favor certainly novels and long form. So I'm not sure why it's not being reflected in the market these days. But hopefully that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
Again. As we go through our various revolutions.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago that you didn't want to make it fully chronological. Can you talk a little bit about structuring these essays, as, you know, thinking of them sort of as the blocks, the building blocks of this book, and how you figured out where to put what? Was there an overarching design that you were thinking about, or how did you decide that would move?
I wrote most of these essays before I put them together in book form, but I knew that chronology was not the best narrative arc for the book, and it wasn't the closest to the emotional truth of the book.
Right.
And so that was sort of the basic premise of the organization and the structure, and you know, I think very deeply about how structure relates to meaning. And there wasn't anything in the idea of chronology that really enhanced meaning for me in this story. So it had to be anachronistic in that way. But putting them together and building them in a way that made the most sense to me as a narrative was a more difficult process.
Mm-hmm.
But also fun. You know, it was fun to see how the arc would change if I moved them. And I think I found the right arc, but that came later. I mean, that was
right.
That was a conversation with my editor,
like without necessarily saying, "Well, this essay is this, and this is this." But would you say that it was more like an emotional structure, or more of a growth of the character, or something to do with the addiction? What would you say is the structural link?
Well, part of it is just basic storytelling, you know, so needing to reveal certain information at certain times, you know, in order to better understand, you know, later essays, you would have to read, you know, some of the earlier essays.
Okay. Yeah. Even if they weren't chronological.
Even if they weren't chronological.
Right.
So it is an emotional arc, and it is a matter of, you know, building tension, rising tension, you know, all of those basic principles of storytelling, but underneath that, and really the anchor of it, I think, is an emotional truth, for lack of a better term, that sort of holds these stories together that I, you know, that I was trying to chase down.
Okay, great. You were, this book was mentioned in Oprah's magazine, and you've gotten some great reviews. Did you ever expect this kind of feedback or support from the media, and how is that going for you? Like, how does that affect you?
It's interesting. No, I didn't expect anything. I didn't expect it to get published. I didn't expect it to, certainly not to be in Oprah's magazine. And that's all lovely and wonderful. I think low expectations has been my biggest ally because everything's a boon. I mean, everything's great. So I had no delusions of grandeur with this book. I knew it would be a quiet book. I knew it would be a tough sell. I knew the subject matter would be difficult to, it would be difficult to avoid being pigeonholed because of the subject matter and addiction and, you know, and family and being a young writer and writing a memoir about family and addiction. It's a lot of strikes against you from the get-go, and I knew that. So, you know, I knew that I had written a good book and that it wasn't about those. It didn't lend itself to just being thrown in another pile of another family addiction memoir.
Right.
But I knew that that would be tough to surmount. So any you know, positive review or attention, it's just, you know, that's just great because I had no expectations. I still don't. So everything's wonderful, you know.
Right, right.
That would be my advice for writers, is just don't have any, you know, don't have high expectations. And then every little thing is great.
Is great. Okay. So my last question is always for listeners who are writers. And I wondered if you in particular could talk about moving through essay, you know, advice for how to structure. Again, we're talking about structure, but within a single essay, like as you're writing, do you tend to structure as you go, or do you do that in revision? And what's your advice for writers who are maybe struggling with how to structure an essay?
I think part of my advice would be to not feel so wedded to chronology. I think chronology, especially in memoir, can be really limiting. And make transitions clunky. And I think if you are writing memoir, trying to adhere to a more emotional truth rather than a factual truth, then the structure sort of evolves naturally around that. Mm-hmm. You know, so things they come together and they juxtapose in ways that lend themselves to meaning as opposed to a timeline.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.
This has been fun. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jessica Hendry Nelson. You can learn more about her work at her website, jessicahendrynelson.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Battery Street Jeans, where vintage and recycled clothing come together through love. Happy days. Located at 7 Marble Avenue, the south end of Burlington. For more information, check out batterystreetjeans.com. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone. BurlingtonTelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. This week's Write the Book prompt was recommended by my guest, Jessica Hendry Nelson. Write a letter of apology of which you don't mean a word. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.